In composing this seditious letter, Damian was aware of three crimes he was committing. The ranch belongs to the church, and I'm stealing it for my family. I'm drafting letters when Governor Franquis has forbidden anyone to do so. And I'm trying to slip my letters past the officials at San Juan Bautista who have orders to prevent the entry into Mexico proper of clandestine letters. But then he thought of Benita and her children. I must take the chances. In one of the other missions, he found a Franciscan who was heading back to Zacatecas. And since this friar also hated Franquis, he volunteered to take the risk. The letter reached the archbishop, who was now viceroy. And when he inquired about the reputation of the Saldanhas, he found it to be exemplary. Whereupon he signed a grant, awarding former Captain Saldanha more than 9,000 leagues, 25,000 acres, along the Medina. Later, when he learned of Damian's insubordination, he bore no resentment. For by this time it was evident even to Madrid that Governor Franquis was a horrendous mistake, and he was deposed after little more than a year of his reckless despotism. The unfortunate man had been correct, however, in some of his charges against Damian. He had been so preoccupied with building the mission that he had not attended to the winning of souls, and repeatedly he had left the mission without permission to go wandering through the Apacharia. When it became apparent that he was to be removed from Santa Teresa, Damian recommended that Fray Eusebio be given permanent charge of the mission. But Eusebio protested that he was far too humble to warrant such an exalted position. Instead, Zacatecas sent up the trail to Béjar, two young friars to assume control at Santa Teresa, one with major orders to replace Fray Damian, and one with minor to take over the work done by Fray Domingo. Damian greeted the two with the warmest brotherhood, and even relief, for he knew that his effectiveness had waned. He was 51 now, and extremely tired, so that rest in some quiet corner of the Franciscan Empire seemed highly desirable. But as the father principal in Zacatecas had proposed, he would stay on at Santa Teresa until the transition had been smoothly made. The new friars were enthusiastic young men, prepared to repair the situation in Béjar, as they phrased it, and their eagerness to take command provided Damian time to evaluate what he had accomplished on the frontier. "Nothing," he told Alvaro and Benita. "I feel my life's been a waste." When they asked why, he replied, "Conversions to Jesus? I haven't brought 2 dozen souls to salvation." "That was Domingo's task," Benita said consolingly. "But I've done so little." He felt old and futile and superseded. "Let's look at what you and I have accomplished," Alvaro proposed, and he recited their litany of constructive deeds. "We brought order to a region which knew it not, and we've established regular mail connections with Saltillo." On he went, naming those simple deeds which taken together represented the quiet triumph of civilization. But this was not enough for Benita, because she, better than either of the brothers, thought she knew the cause of Damian's malaise. "He sees his life running out, and without a wife or children to represent him when he's gone, he fears it might have been in vain." So she began to tick off his particular achievements. "You built the irrigation systems, and when Mission Espada needed an aqueduct for its water supply, you showed them how to build one." Stopping, she formed an arch with her fingers and said, "Building an arch that will stand is something, believe me." She spoke of the compound walls he had erected, of the church, of the houses for the Indians. And then she mentioned the one thing of which she knew he was truly proud. "You encouraged Simone to finish his Stations of the Cross. Yes, when we three die, we shall leave in Béjar an enduring memory." When she uttered the word "die," applying it even to herself, Damian shuddered, and in the silence that followed, he acknowledged for the first time that his mournfulness stemmed from growing awareness of his own approaching death. Life is so brief. We should have accomplished so much, and we did so little. My three sons, Benita snapped. I call them something. And Alvaro's promotion to colonel, I call that something, too. Damian could not accept this reprieve. Once we had Santa Teresa firmly planted, I should have gone to Nacogdoches and brought order to the frontier. And after Alvaro established order here, he should have gone on to Los Ades and done the same there. We do a little, and claim it was a lot. Benita rose from her chair, walked to where Damian sat, and placed her hand on his shoulder. We can be proud of the Besar we built. It will stand here for a long time, a long time. She bit her lip and pressed Damian's shoulder. And you can be proud, Damian. 200 years from now, when the work of your mission is long completed, your Church of Santa Teresa will still stand, and people will applaud it. Yes, I saw that last report of the inspectors from Querétaro. No mission north of Saltillo, neither in Sonora nor in Tejas, excels what Friar Damian has achieved in Béjar. She bent down and kissed him. Cherishing her touch, he looked up and whispered, I suppose it's important that Indians have food if they're to work at Christian duties. And it's very important they have decent houses. And a mission needs walls to keep goodness in and evil out. But I merely built walls. Domingo built souls. As the long evening ended, he tried to summarize. I've one regret I can't erase. I failed to convince Madrid to send us enough real Spanish settlers, farmers who would farm, knitters who would knit. When he fell silent, Alvaro nodded. That was our great failure. I don't discount the Mexican mestizo. All things considered, Simón Garza is one of the best human beings I've ever known, and there must be others like him. But what does the government in Mexico City send us? Rabble, rubbish, and they expect to build a province with such people? As he uttered these harsh and true indictments of Spanish policy, he did concede that the Council of the Indies had made one serious effort to settle the North. And when he thought of those contentious Canary Islanders calling themselves Hidalgos, he had to chuckle. They're the best Spaniards we have, and if the king had sent us 50 more boatloads, we could have settled Tejas and conquered Louisiana, too. He was in this frame of mind one afternoon when the inescapable Juan Leal Goras, his long beard unkempt, appeared at the mission, his devious mind busily at work. Fray Damian, I do not come with pleasant news. Your men here at the mission are drawing down more water than we agreed upon, and I'm starting a lawsuit against you before you escape from Tejas. How many suits have you and I had before, Don Juan? 5, and each one essential for the protection of our interests. And how many have you won? None, but that's not the point. Each suit brought to your attention some grievous wrong which you then had the sense to correct. Why didn't you just come and complain without the lawsuits? Because you damned friars will never listen to mere words. But when I start a suit, you clean out your ears. Pushing his face close to Damian's, he added, And don't be fooled by the score, 5 suits, 5 losses. How could it be otherwise when the judges are all corrupt, all in the pockets of you friars? All the judges? I've conducted lawsuits in all parts of the world. You mean the Canaries and Tejas? It's the same the world over. Judges are corrupt. Suppose that when you do engage your suit, Don Juan, that I bring witnesses to prove that you've dug a branch of your canal for which you have no permit, which was not in our agreement, and I prove that it is you who are breaking the law, not I. That's the kind of argument corrupt judges listen to. At this point, Don Juan shifted the discussion dramatically. Fray Damian, we couldn't have had a better missionary in Bejar than you, nor a better captain than your brother. I want him to stay on as a civilian. Why don't you stay, too, as our parish priest? The suggestion was so improper to make to a Franciscan, whose mission in life was to wander, not to tend a specific church, that Damian remained mute. But it was also flattering, coming as it did from Goras, who pressed on, interpreting the friar's hesitancy as indecision, "Our whole community wants to have you stay. You're a man we've learned to trust." Goras could see the friar thinking intensely, but not even his conniving mind could have guessed what Damian was thinking. "I could stay here with Alvaro and Benita and watch their sons grow. My home would not be broken." Slowly, and in some confusion, he told Goras, "I'm a Franciscan. I go where God sends me." And as soon as Goras left, Damian started making his own secret plans to go on a mission which he felt that God had authorized, once more among the Apache, hoping that this time his example of fearlessness and brotherhood would encourage them to consider peace. One afternoon, when his preparations were almost complete, he went quietly into his little church, and in the quiet shadows he studied once more Simón Garza's Stations of the Cross, contemplating both their beauty and the religious mystery they represented. How fortunate I was to work with men like Simón and Domingo. They made the things I tried to do doubly effective. And how wonderful that I should have done my work in companionship with Jesus Christ. As he looked at Garza's depiction of the crucifixion, he could feel the nails in Christ's hands, the thorns digging into his brow. He was such a good man on earth, such a kind man in heaven. As he prayed before the last station, he noticed that the two young friars now responsible for Santa Teresa had also entered the church, and unaware that Fray Damian was there, they were talking like young enthusiasts. "I've found this quarry, rock so soft you cut it with a saw. But when it's sun-dried in place, it hardens like granite. Tufa, they call it. With such stones, we could replace the adobe, make this a real church. Better yet, we could replace everything." At this, Damian gasped, for he could not imagine sacrificing Simone's glorious stations. The young friars now discovered him, and realizing that he must have heard their plans, were eager to apologize. "We didn't know you were here. We're so sorry." "No, no, I assure you, it's time to build a new church."
"Do you really approve?"
"Yes," he cried vehemently. "Each man builds only for his generation. Everything he does ought to be restudied, improved by those who follow." He waved his hand deprecatingly. "I built so poorly. They told me in Zacatecas, you need build only in wood for temporary use." His voice dropped to a whisper. "But the heart yearns to build in stone for eternity." As he moved his right arm across the spread of the little church, his eyes were directed to the Stations of the Cross, and almost as if he were a parent defending his children, he stepped before the carvings and lifted his arms to cover one of them. "I would not want you to replace these, not destroy them, that is." And his plea was so profound that one of the young friars stooped and kissed his hand. "We would never have damaged them, Brother Damian. We planned to have them as the heart of our new church." "Did you?" he asked in great excitement. And as the two moved about the church, explaining to each other how the roof could be taken off and the walls replaced with minimum confusion, he stayed with them, encouraging them, and talking far more than was necessary. On the 21st of September, 1737, when day and night stood even across the world, Damian left his mission riding a mule with a donkey in tow. He rode westward toward Rancho El Codo, which Alvaro, Benita, and their sons now owned, and here he stopped to utter a long prayer for the soul of Domingo Pacheco as it made its way through purgatory to heaven. He spent his first night at the ranch and rose refreshed and eager for the serious part of his journey. Not till 3 days later did he make contact with any Apache. Then he came upon a good-sized band, which did not include either the squaw or any of the chiefs who had known him earlier, although there were members who had heard of the decent manner in which he had treated other Apache. They made him as welcome as Apache ever did, but he was aware that some of the younger braves resented him and were advising their fellows against any contact with a Spaniard. In the 2 days he spent in the Apacheria, he found some leaders who were willing to listen when he explained about the advantages of Christianity and an orderly life within the Spanish Empire. "Like me," he told them, "you will enjoy the full protection of the king." He was convinced that the conversion of the Apache was at hand, and that God had sent him to be the agent. But on the third day, in the midst of the most serious explanation of how God and his Son Jesus Christ shared responsibilities in heaven, three impatient young braves kicked aside a buffalo skin before which Damian sat, seized him, and dragged him to an oak tree, from which they hung him by his thumbs. Then, before the older chiefs could protest, which they showed little inclination to do, the young men stripped the dangling body and began making little cuts across it with their flint scrapers. They were not deep, just a slash on the arm or on the leg. But the young men kept darting back and forth, now away from Damian, now toward him, always making another small cut, until his body was red-stained in all its parts. The young men now called upon the women of the tribe, and with obvious delight the squaws joined them, dancing around and making deeper cuts in parts of the body hitherto untouched. One woman, hair falling across her dark face, evil-smelling, was lifted up to cut at the base of his left thumb, not severing it, but nearly so. She and her sisters wanted to see how long it took for the weight of the body to pull the damaged thumb apart. And when this happened, and the body swung sideways, suspended only by the right thumb and twirling in a tight circle, the women shrieked with pleasure and ran back to stab at the body that now gushed blood from various deep wounds. Damian, still conscious, for no cuts had yet been made in a vital place, held to his belief that this hideous affair was merely a ritual torture. But now, two of the women rushed up and made such deep slashes in the lower part of his stomach that a great shudder ran through all his body, visible to his tormentors. "He dies! He dies!" they screamed, and this encouraged other women to dance in and stab at him. One was even lifted high enough so that she could cut at his throat. But this terrible pain Damian ignored. For when he stared at her hawk-like face, he saw not an Apache woman, but Benita Liñán. She smiled at him, as she had on that first evening in the paseo. And as his blood spurted, she leaned forward to cradle him in her arms. Task Force. San Antonio, loveliest city in Texas, Venice of the Drylands. Its river runs right through the heart of town, providing a colorful waterway for festive barges and an exotic riverside walk along which one could promenade forever. How glad I was to be coming back to a city I had cherished as a boy, for this had been my family's preferred vacation spot. I remembered well the Buckhorn Saloon, that relic of the Old West, with its fantastic guns and cattle horns. I sneaked my first beer there, my mother watching from a distance, then teasing when I spat it out. Later, When I returned from Europe to find the Buckhorn moved, I felt as if my youth had officially ended. San Antonio. Conservative. Always lagging behind more daring towns like Houston and Dallas, it had long been the largest city in Texas, but had now given way to those two giants. Recently it had stunned the state by electing as mayor a man of Spanish heritage, and in decades to come it might once more become a leading city because of the spectacular development of its Spanish-speaking population. For our April meeting, there our staff had enlisted a Franciscan friar who served in one of the city's famous missions, Friar Clarence Cummings, born in Albany, New York. He was respected as an expert on the five surviving missions that line the river like a string of jewels on a necklace. But even before he appeared, he caused animosity in our task force. Rusk complained, "I didn't join this committee to get a course in Catholic theology." And Quimper chimed in, "If this keeps up, next meeting will be a public baptism." This was too much for Professor Garza, a wise and prudent Catholic. "What makes you think the friar will try to proselytize you?" And Rusk growled, "He better not try." In 2 minutes, Friar Clarence won the skeptics over, or at least neutralized them. He was a tall, good-looking, robust fellow in his late 30s, clad in a brown robe, bare feet in rugged leather sandals. After the briefest introduction, he said in no-nonsense style, "I hope you'll join me in a cell we use as a projection room, because it's important that you see the slides I've prepared." And when we were seated with our staff in the cell in the Mission San Jose, he surprised us with the title of his talk, "Form and Legacy." "Now, what does that mean?" Quimper asked, and he replied, "That's what I've come to explain." With carefully organized notes accompanying a set of excellent colored slides he had prepared from his own drawings and photographs, he began his talk with a promise. "I propose to concentrate on two subjects only, the physical form of the Spanish mission in its heyday and its legacy for us today. No theology, no moralizing. We begin with this simple question, which must have preoccupied those in charge at the time. If your mission is to fulfill its purpose, what form should it take?" At that, he darkened the cell, and with the heavy stone walls enclosing us, we had little difficulty in imagining ourselves back in 1720. This drawing, I studied architecture at Cornell before joining the Franciscans at a rather advanced age, shows the landscape you will have to work with. The wandering river, the loop where the horses pasture, the flat land where your mission will ultimately stand. With seven choice slides, he showed us the terrain of San Antonio as it must have been in 1717, with no mission visible. "Since you are Spaniards, imbued with the traditions of your homeland, you will insist upon centralization, with civilian settlers and their activities clustered closely together. A main difference between Catholic Spain and Protestant America, I've always thought, is that Spain likes to collect its citizens in villages dominated by the church. There they find mutual protection during the night. During the day, when conditions are safer, they can march out to their distant fields. Americans, fed up with clerical control both in Europe and New England, want their homes and farms as far apart as possible. I grew up in rural New York, with the nearest farm half a mile away, and you cannot imagine my amazement when I first saw the crowded little villages of Spain and Italy, one house abutting the other. 'How do they breathe?' I thought, 'and how do they get to their distant fields each morning?'" He warned us not to attribute this spatial difference to social factors. The attacks of Apache and Comanche in Texas were just as severe as the attacks of marauding armies in Europe, but the Americans refused to cluster for protection, while the Spaniards did. In San Antonio, your civilians will cluster. Under his guidance, we did imagine ourselves about to build a mission in 1719. And while we were in this frame of mind, he flashed onto the screen a majestic slide of the Alamo, that sacred mission, heavily rebuilt, around which the soul of Texas rallies. This time it had been photographed at dusk, with an ominous cloud to the east. And after it had been on the screen for a few moments, Miss Cobb wiped her eyes with a handkerchief, and I noticed that the staff, then even Quimper, and finally Rusk, followed with similar reactions. Here was a photograph that would affect the heart of any Texan who saw it unexpectedly. Within those walls, brave men had died defending a principle in which they believed. On those parapets, my ancestor, illiterate Moses Barlow, had given his life for a cause with which he had been associated for less than 2 weeks. Rapidly, in a series of beautiful slides, the friar now gave us a swift review of the four other surviving missions, those heavy structures with such delicate names. San José y San Miguel, Nuestra Señora de la Purísima Concepción, San Francisco de la Espada, and the one I preferred, San Juan Capistrano. He showed them in storm, in sunlight, at evening with birds nesting, and at the break of day with a golden sun exploding over their walls. He showed us architectural fragments and stretches of reconstructed walls and windows glowing with majesty and fonts where the friars washed their feet. And after a while we became so much a part of those missions that we were prepared to listen to what he had to say about us. Our five San Antonio missions cannot compare in raw beauty with the handsomely preserved and reconstructed missions of California. We have no one superb example of architecture like Santa Barbara, no outstanding summary of mission life like Fray Junipero Serra's San Carlos Borromeo, and the reason is simple. Since the Spanish missionaries in California were not required to face extremely hostile Indians, they did not have to fortify their buildings. They could enjoy the luxury of graceful architecture and widely spaced structures. But our poor friars in Tejas had to build both a church and a fortress to protect it. Most experts agree that if you want to understand mission life, you must come to San Antonio, because our rude buildings, constructed without guile, represent what the mission experience was all about. And now, at the halfway point in my talk, we're going to leave this cell and move out to see the structures themselves. To visit the five missions of San Antonio was like walking slowly and with deep passion into the beginnings of Texas history. Each was different. The Alamo had been massively added to. It was really a museum as well as a sacred gathering place, always cluttered with visitors. San José had also been rebuilt, most faithfully, and best represented what mission life had been like within its spacious walls and its little cubicles for Indians. But the mission that clutched at my heart from the time I first saw it as a boy, giving me insight into those early days, was Capistrano, with its simpler lines, its lovely three-part bell tower, and especially that long, severe wall with the five cemented archways. It spoke to me with such force that even now I fell silent when I saw it. The Alamo had awed me. San José had delighted me. But Capistrano, when I stood before its simplicity, invited me to become a member of its congregation, concerned about its canal and the gathering of its crops. As we gazed at this noble relic, Friar Clarence altered the tenor of his talk. "So much for the past. You've seen what form these missions took, and a very good one it was. But what concerns us now is the legacy of these missions in the life of modern Texas. So as we stand here, I want you to focus on the Acequia, the little canal that brought water to the mission. It ran over there, we think, and today, when Texas needs water so badly that it dreams up all kinds of tricks to find and save it, it's interesting to remember that our first irrigation ditches were dug by the friars of these San Antonio missions. An unusual Franciscan worked here in the 1720s, Fray Damián de Saldaña, born in Spain, who had great skill in laying out irrigation systems. He could be called the father of Texan water conservation, and the work he did back then is as functional as anything we attempt today. I've often thought that the farmers and ranchers and citrus growers who lead water onto their lands should contribute a mite of their profit for a statue to that far-seeing friar. "Was he that important?" Rosk asked, and Quimper jumped in. "Any man who can show Texas how to use its water is a certified Lone Star hero." When we returned to the projection room, we were eager to hear how Friar Clarence would link the missions to modern Texas. If Spain had given us nothing but these five missions, the legacy would have been monumental. Because they had a fine, solid form, they stand today as treasures of the First Order. So even though they do reach us in damaged or altered state, we can still thank the prudence of our predecessors that they exist at all, because in such buildings the spiritual history of Texas is preserved. But whenever he approached such religious matters, he remembered his promise. But we're talking about form and function, not theology. And I would like to close with a reminder of how creatively the mission discharged its obligations in the early 1700s, and how, its job done, it made itself obsolete by the end of the century. San Juan Capistrano, which seems to have affected our chairman so deeply, is a case in point. Founded near Nacogdoches in 1716, it died there, and its functions were moved to a spot near Austin. Dying again, it was brought to San Antonio, where it enjoyed some success. As many as 250 Indian residents, 5,000 head of cattle, its own cotton fields and woolen manufacturing. But by 1793, when it had to be secularized, only a dozen Christianized Indians, less than 20 cattle, and the looms in disrepair. "What does secularize mean?" Rusk asked, and I was impressed by the manner in which this extremely capable man was always willing to reveal his ignorance when an unusual word was introduced whose exact meaning he wished to learn. Instead of replying in words, Friar Clarence flashed onto the wall a series of photographs showing the five missions as they had existed at various times in the 19th and 20th centuries, before restoration began. We were shocked at their pitiful condition. Walls down, garbage piled high, roofs fallen in, and ruin in each little church. "Strictly speaking," Friar Clarence explained, "to secularize means to convert from religious ownership and use to civil. Like today, when an urban congregation finds that its members have moved to the suburbs and it sells the church building to some little theater group. In Texas, the word carries a special meaning. For when the missions finished trying to tame the frontier and Christianize the Indians, in both of which they had limited success, the system had no further utility. So the church turned the missions back to the civil government. Hungry fingers grabbed for the valuable land, but nobody could see any use for the buildings, so they were allowed to fall into ruin or removed for other construction." On that mournful note, the slides concluded. When the lights came up, I saw that he kept his head bowed, and for some moments he remained that way. Then he smiled and said softly, "How beautiful a concept, and how suddenly it was outmoded." "Why?" Miss Cobb asked, and he turned to her. "I believe that many meritorious ideas are allowed a lifespan of about 30 years. Liberalism in France flourished briefly before World War II, made its contribution, and vanished. Dr. Spock's theories of child-rearing set a generation free, then collapsed in excess. The Erie Canal in my home state, and the mission concept as applied to Texas. All made great contributions, then perished. Railroads outmoded your Erie Canal after its allotted life," Miss Cobb said. "And airplanes killed many railroads and almost all the ocean liners. What killed your missions?" He reflected on this, then chuckled. "Texas. Now what does that mean? Miss Cobb pursued. From its start, any Texas mission was destined for a short life. Distances were so great, the Indians were so intractable. So often, when its work failed in one place, it moved on to some other challenge. If that's true, why do I see 5 stone buildings? Ah, he cried, a light burning in his eyes. You can never convince a man like the Fray Damian of whom I spoke that what he's doing is temporary. Once he positions that first adobe, he begins to build for eternity. But you say his mission has disappeared? Others killed it, not he. Damian succeeded beyond imagination. His form vanished, completely destroyed. But the legacy survives. As he said this, his face assumed a radiance which warmed us. I promised you at the beginning no theology, no moralizing, just form and legacy. But you must have deduced from what I've said that the Texas missions would provide us with only a limited legacy if they were mere architecture. Their grandeur is twofold, art plus the spiritual force which evoked that art. The friars could not have survived in this wilderness without some guiding principle, and it was Christianity. There were drunkards among the friars, and some who chased after Indian girls, and others who had never known vocation. But there were also men of supreme devotion, and upon their efforts the future city of San Antonio and the state of Texas were founded. That is their legacy. His words had an astonishing result. Friar Clarence, Rusk said in his deep and rumbling voice, you ought to change your name. It doesn't sound appropriate here in a nest of missions. What would you advise? Friar Ignacio, Friar Bernardo, something Spanish. I suppose we're all stuck with the names we were given. Rusk seems totally inappropriate for a man of your power. What had you in mind? Midas, Croesus, maybe Carnegie. You gave us a terrific explanation, Friar Clarence. Now tell me, how much would it cost to print your lecture in a book to be given free to all the schools in Texas? I was surprised that a Texas billionaire would concern himself with pennies, but he addressed the problem scientifically, as if it involved great sums. Barlow, call a printing house and find out. When I reported, they say that they can give you a black-and-white edition for about 60 cents a copy, he gave one of his rare smiles and said, that seems reasonable. Friar Clarence, I'd like to print such a book. Give young people the real story of the missions, just as you gave it to us. You're a very solid young man, and your ideas merit circulation. Friar Clarence said tentatively that he would be honored, but I could see from his hesitation that he expected some catch, and Rusk revealed it. Of course, I'd want to eliminate that last part on the religious bit. Instantly, the young scholar said, then I wouldn't be interested, because obviously you've missed the whole point of my talk. Form and function were the outer manifestations of the mission. The heart and core was the religious conviction, and don't you forget it. Publish a book about missions and ignore their religious base. Oh, no. But Rusk was a clever man, and he said something now which absolutely stunned me in its simplicity and moral deviousness. I mean a booklet with illustrations, your excellent drawings, your photographs in color. You could see that Friar Clarence was startled by this new dimension, but you could also see the poison of vanity working in him. Ransom Rusk was the serpent in paradise, tempting not Eve with an apple, but a Franciscan friar with an image of a fine book in which his words would be distributed to Texas schools. Very slowly, he said, I would like to see that done, Mr. Rusk. And Rusk rose and clapped him on the shoulder, whereupon Friar Clarence added, But I would insist upon that last section, for it would be the soul of my book. And in that simple statement, the book became his and not Rusk's. Now Rusk had to think. He certainly did not want to subsidize Catholic propaganda, and he temporized by asking our staff, "How much would the cost be elevated if we used color, maybe 16 full pages of his best photos and drawings?" The young people consulted on this, recalling projects of a similar nature on which they had been engaged, and they suggested, "Total cost, about $2.50 a copy, but only if you print in large batches." "That would be possible. Now, Friar Clarence, here's what I propose. That you and I will agree that Miss Cobb here, a good Protestant, and Professor Garza, an equally good Catholic, will study those last remarks to see if they're acceptable. I mean, not rank proselytizing. Agreed?" The young friar considered this for some moments, then extended his hand. But as Rusk reached to grasp it, Friar Clarence said to Garza, "I'll depend on you to see that the vital material stays in." And Rusk responded as he accepted the hand, "I'll depend on you, Miss Lorena, to see that the truth of the black legend is not completely whitewashed."